In 1845, Jacob Todd had gotten off Captain John Summers' ship with renewed health and energy, eager to put behind him the shameful incident in Valparaiso, and devote himself body and soul to establishing in England the utopian community he had so long dreamed of. He carried a thick notebook, yellowed by use and sea air, filled with ideas. Every detail of the community had been studied and planned down to the smallest detail. He was certain that many young people, the old would not be interested, would abandon their dreary lives to become part of an idealistic brotherhood of free men and women under a system of absolute equality without authorities, police, or religion. Potential candidates for the experiment were not as quick to respond as he had expected, but after a few months he had two or three willing to give it a try. All he needed was a Maecenas to finance the costly undertaking, which would require a sizable piece of land, because the community was to live apart from the aberrations of the world, and yet must satisfy all its wants. Todd had initiated conversations with a crackpot lord who had a large estate in Ireland. When rumors about the scandal in Valparaiso caught up with him in London and dogged him till he had no breathing room left. Again, doors closed to him, and he lost his friends and disciples. His noblemen disclaimed him, and his dreams of utopia went down the drain. As once before, Jacob Todd sought consolation in alcohol, and he sank into a swamp of devastating memories. He was living like a rat in a third-rate boarding house when the lifeline thrown by his friend reached him. He did not think twice. He changed his name and set sail for the United States, hoping to find a bright new destiny. His one goal was to bury his shame and live in anonymity until the time he could revive his idyllic project. First and foremost, he must get a job. His income had been reduced, and the glorious days of idleness had come to a halt. When he reached New York, he had introduced himself to a couple of newspaper men, offering his services as a correspondent in California, and then had made the trip west across the Isthmus of Panama, because he didn't have the heart to go by way of the Straits of Magellan and find himself back in Valparaiso, where his shame awaited, undiminished, and the beautiful Miss Rose would hear his name besmirched once more. In California, his friend Feliciano Rodriguez de Santa Cruz helped him find a place to live and employment on the oldest newspaper in San Francisco. Jacob Todd, now Jacob Fremont, started working for the first time in his life, discovering to his amazement that he enjoyed it. He wandered the region writing about anything that caught his eye, including Indian massacres, immigrants flooding in from every corner of the planet, uncontrolled price gouging by merchants, the miners, quick justice, and vice in general. One of his articles nearly cost him his life. He described, not naming names but with perfect clarity, the way some gaming houses operated with marked dice, oiled cards, watered liquor, drugs, prostitution, and the practice of getting women dead drunk and then for a dollar selling them to as many men who wanted the right to make sport with them. All of this protected by the same authorities who should be combating such vices, he wrote in conclusion. He was threatened by gangsters, the chief of police, and politicians, and sometimes had to lie low until tempers cooled. Despite that misstep, his articles appeared regularly, and his was becoming a pen people respected. As he told his friend John Summers, in seeking anonymity, he was finding celebrity. At the end of the meal, Jacob Fremont invited his friends to see the sensation of the day, a Chinese girl whom one could watch but not touch. Her name was Ah Toy, and she had sailed on a clipper with her husband, an elderly merchant who had the good taste to die at sea and leave her free. She lost no time in a widow's laments, and to enliven the rest of the journey, she became the lover of the captain, who turned out to be a generous man. When she debarked in San Francisco, showily gowned and with a heavy purse, she noticed the lustful gazes that followed her and was struck with the brilliant idea of charging for those looks. She rented two rooms, cut holes in the dividing wall, and then charged an ounce of gold for the privilege of looking at her. Jacob Fremont's friends followed him in good humor, and with the bribe of a few dollars, they were able to jump the line and be among the first to enter. They were led into a narrow room, thick with tobacco smoke, where a dozen men stood elbow to elbow, with noses pressed to the wall. They peered through the uncomfortable peepholes, feeling like ridiculous schoolboys, and saw in the next room a beautiful young woman, dressed in a silk kimono slit on both sides from waist to toes. Underneath it, she was naked. The voyeurs groaned at each of the languid movements that revealed part of her delicate body. John Summers and the Rodriguez de Santa Cruz brothers doubled over laughing, unable to believe that hunger for women could be so consuming. Afterward, they went their separate ways, and the captain and the newspaper man left to have a last drink. After listening to the accounts of Jacob's voyages and adventures, the captain decided to confide in him. "Do you remember Eliza, the girl who lived with my brother and sister in Valparaiso?" "Perfectly. She ran away from home nearly a year ago, and I have good reason to believe that she is in California. I have tried to find her, but no one knows anything about her or anyone of her description. And the only women who come here alone are prostitutes. I don't know how she came, if she did. The one fact we have is that she left in search of her lover, a young Chilean by the name of Joaquin Andieta."
"Joaquin Andieta, I know him. He was my friend in Chile."
"He is a fugitive from justice, accused of theft." "I can't believe it. Andieta was an upstanding young man. In truth, he had such a strong sense of pride and honor that it made it difficult to get close to him. And you are telling me that he and Eliza are in love?" "I know only that he embarked for California in December of 1848. 2 months later, the girl disappeared. My sister believes she came here, following Andieta, although I can't imagine how she did that without leaving a trail. Since you move around through the camps and towns in the north, I thought you might find out something." "I will do what I can, Captain. My brother and sister would be eternally grateful, Jacob."
Eliza Summers stayed with the caravan of Joe Bonecrusher, where she played the piano and shared her tips 50-50 with the madam. She bought books of songs in both English and Spanish to liven up the long nights of entertainment and for idle hours, which were many. She taught the Indian lad to read and helped with the daily chores and the cooking. Everyone in the carnival said that they had never eaten better. With the same eternal dried beef, beans, and bacon, she prepared savory dishes created in the inspiration of the moment. She bought Mexican condiments and added them to Mama Frisia's Chilean recipes with delicious results. She had only lard, flour, and preserved fruits, but she made pies, and when she could get eggs and milk, her creations rose to celestial gastronomic heights. Babalu the Bad was not a believer in men cooks, but he was the first to wolf down the young pianist's banquets and so had to stifle his sarcastic comments. In the habit of being on guard during the night, the giant slept like a log most of the day, but as soon as a whiff from the cook pots wafted to his dragon nostrils, his eyes flew open and he sat down near the kitchen to wait. He had an insatiable appetite, and there was no way to fill his gigantic belly. Before the arrival of Chile Boy, as they call the supposed Elias Andieta, his basic diet had been whatever game he caught, split down the middle, seasoned with a handful of salt, and laid on the coals till it was black. Following that method, he would eat a whole deer in a couple of days. Exposed to the cuisine of the pianist, he refined his palate, hunted every day, selected the most delicate prize, and delivered it skinned and dressed. On the road, Eliza led the caravan on her sturdy nag, which, despite its sorry appearance, was as princely as the finest purebred, with her useless rifle strapped onto her saddle, and the young Indian drummer riding on the horse's croup. She felt so comfortable in men's clothes that she wondered whether she would ever be able to dress like a woman again. Of one thing she was sure. She would never wear a corset, not even on the day of her marriage to Joaquin Andieta. If they came to a river, the women seized the opportunity to collect water in barrels, wash clothes, and bathe. Those were Eliza's most difficult moments. She had to invent more and more contrived excuses for cleaning up out of sight of observers. Joe Bonecrusher was a corpulent Pennsylvania Dutch woman who had found her destiny in the wide open spaces of the West. She had a prestidigitator skill with cards and dice, and she was passionate about cheating. She had earned a living betting until she got the idea to organize a crew of girls and travel the motherlode prospecting for gold, which was what she called her method of mining. She was sure that the young pianist was homosexual, and that was why she made room for him in her heart beside the young Indian. She did not allow her girls to tease him or Babalu to call him names. It wasn't the kid's fault that he was born without a beard and with that baby face, just as it wasn't hers that she had been born a man in a woman's body. These were just jokes God invented to screw things up. She had bought the Indian boy for $30 from some vigilantes who had killed the rest of his tribe. He was 4 or 5 at the time, nothing but a skeleton with a worm-filled belly. But within a few months of forcibly feeding him and taming his rage, so he didn't destroy everything within reach or beat his head against the wagon wheels, he had grown a hand's width, and his true warrior's nature had emerged. He was stoic, hermetic, and patient. She named him Tom No Tribe so he would never forget the debt of revenge. "The name is the person," Indian said, and Joe believed it. That was why she had invented her own name. The soiled doves of the caravan consisted of 2 sisters from Missouri who had made the long trip overland and lost the rest of their family on the way. Esther, a girl of 18, who had run away from her father, a religious fanatic who beat her, and a beautiful Mexican, the daughter of a white father and an Indian mother, who passed for white and had learned 4 phrases in French to bamboozle men who had only one thing in mind, because, according to popular myth, French girls were the best. In that society of adventurers and ruffians, there was also a racial hierarchy. Whites accepted cinnamon-skinned girls, but scorned any mixture with black. All 4 women were grateful for having run across Joe Bonecrusher. Esther was the only one without previous experience. The others had practiced their trade in San Francisco and knew the bad life. They hadn't worked in the best houses. They knew about beatings, sickness, drugs, and the evil of pimps. They had had countless infections, suffered brutal remedies, and had had so many abortions that they were sterile, which they considered a blessing, not a tragedy. Joe had rescued them from that vile world and taken them out of the city. Then she had supported them during their long martyrdom of withdrawal to rid them of addiction to opium and alcohol. The women repaid her with the loyalty of daughters, and besides, she treated them fair and square. The intimidating presence of Babalu discouraged violent customers and hateful drunks. They ate well, and the rambling wagon seemed a favorable atmosphere for good health and spirits. In those far-stretching spaces of hills and forests, they felt free. There was nothing easy or romantic about their lives. They had saved a little money and could leave if they wanted, yet they didn't, because that small band of humans was the closest thing to a family they had. Joe Bonecrusher's girls, too, were convinced that young Elias Andieta, with his effeminate manners and high voice, was homosexual. That gave them leave to undress, wash, and talk about any subject when he was around, as if he were one of them. They accepted him so naturally that Eliza tended to forget she was supposed to be male, although Babalu made it his job to remind her. He had taken on the task of making a man out of this lily-livered weakling, and he watched Elias closely, quick to correct him when he sat with his legs crossed or shook back his short mane with a very unmanly gesture. He taught him how to clean and oil his weapons, but gave up trying to teach him to shoot because every time his student pressed the trigger, he closed his eyes. He was not impressed by Elias Andieta's Bible. On the contrary, he suspected he used it to justify his childish ways and complained that if the boy did not want to become a damned preacher, why the hell did he read all that foolishness anyway? He'd be better off reading dirty books to see if that gave him any ideas about acting like a man. Babalu was barely able to sign his name and read with great difficulty, but he would die before admitting it. He said that his sight was failing and he couldn't see the letters well, although he could shoot a terrified hare between the eyes at 300 yards. He used to ask Chile Boy to read out-of-date newspapers and the Bone Crusher's erotic books aloud, not so much for the sexy parts as the romantic, which always brought him near to tears. The plot invariably had to do with burning love between a member of the European nobility and a common peasant girl, or sometimes the reverse, an aristocratic lady who lost her mind over a rustic but honest and proud man. In these tales, the women were always beautiful, and the gallants tireless in their ardor. The backdrop was a series of bacchanals, but unlike pornographic dime novels, these had a plot. Eliza would read aloud, masking her shock, as if she had always been exposed to the worst vices, while Babalu and three of the doves listened, mesmerized. Esther did not participate in those sessions, because to her it seemed a worse sin to describe the acts than to perform them. Eliza's ears burned, but she could not help but recognize the unexpected elegance with which these lusty tales were written. Some of the sentences even reminded her of the impeccable style of Miss Rose. Joe Bonecrusher, who was not the least interested in carnal passion of any sort, and so was bored by the reading, personally saw that not a word wounded the innocent ears of Tom Notribe. "I'm raising him to be an Indian chief, not a pimp for whores," she said, and in her wish to make him strong, she also refused to let the boy call her grandmother. "Hell's fire, I'm not anyone's grandmother. I'm the bone crusher, do you hear what I'm saying, you damn brat?" "Yes, Grandma." Babalu the Bad, an ex-convict from Chicago, had crossed the continent on foot long before the gold rush. He spoke Indian tongues and had done a little of everything to earn a living, from strongman in a traveling circus, where he might lift a horse over his head or pull a wagon load of sand by his teeth, to stevedore on the docks of San Francisco. That was where he had been discovered by Joe Bonecrusher and had taken a job in the caravan. He could do the work of several men, and with him, they needed no further protection. Together, he and his employer could scare off any number of attackers, as they had demonstrated on more than one occasion.
"You have to be strong or they grind you down, Chile boy," Babalu counseled Eliza. "I don't think I've always been the way you see me. Once I was like you, weak and soft, but I began lifting weights, and now look at my muscles. No one tries anything with me."
"Babalu, you're more than 6 feet tall and weigh as much as a cow. I'll never be like you."
"Size has nothing to do with it, man. It's balls that count. I may have been big, but they laughed at me just the same."
"Who laughed at you?"
"Everyone, even my mother, may she rest in peace. I'm going to tell you something nobody knows."
"Yes?"
"You remember Babalu the Good? That was me before. But ever since I was 20, I've been Babalu the Bad, and things have gone much better for me."
Soiled Doves. In December, overnight, winter descended upon the foothills, and thousands of miners had to abandon their claims and move to town to wait for spring. A merciful blanket of snow covered that vast terrain, tunneled by greedy ants, and what gold was left again lay quietly in nature's silence. Joe Bonecrusher directed her caravan to one of the new little towns in the Motherlode, where she rented a dilapidated barn in which to hibernate. She sold the mules, bought a great wood trough for a bathtub, one cook stove and two for heat, and a few lengths of cheap cloth and boots for everyone, because in the rain and cold you couldn't do without them. She set them all to scrubbing out the barn and making curtains to mark off rooms. She installed the canopy beds, the golden mirrors, and the piano. Then she went off to pay a courtesy call to the taverns, the general store, and the blacksmith shop, the centers of social activity. In the way of a newspaper, the town had a one-sheet bulletin printed on an aged hand press that had been hauled across the continent, in which Joe placed a discreet announcement of her business. Besides the girls, she offered bottles of what she called the finest Cuban and Jamaican rum, although in truth it was a savage brew that would curl a man's soul, torrid books, and a couple of gambling tables. Customers showed up promptly. There was another brothel, but novelty was welcomed. The madam of the other establishment launched a campaign of slander against her rivals, but refrained from openly confronting the formidable duo of Joe Bonecrusher and Babalu the Bad. In their new quarters, there was frolicking behind the improvised curtains, dancing to the tune of the piano, and betting of considerable sums under the watchful eye of the boss lady, who did not permit any fighting or cheating under her roof, unless her own. Eliza watched men lose in a couple of nights what they'd won with months of titanic effort, then weep on the bosom of the girls who had helped clean them out. In a short time, the miners became very fond of Joe. Despite her piratical mien, the woman had a motherly heart, and that winter fate put it to the test. The area was visited by an epidemic of dysentery that felled half the town, killing several of its victims. As soon as Joe heard about someone near death in some distant cabin, she borrowed a couple of horses from the blacksmith and rode with Babalu to help the poor devil. They were often accompanied by the smith, a formidable Quaker who disapproved of the mammoth woman's livelihood, but was always ready to help a neighbor. Joe would cook for the stricken miner, clean him up, wash his clothes, and console him by reading letters from his far-off family for the 100th time, while Babalu and the blacksmith shoveled snow, hauled water, cut wood, and stacked it by the stove. If the man was really bad off, Joe would wrap him in blankets, throw him over her horse like a sack of flour, and take him back home, where the girls would look after him with the dedication of nurses, happy to have the chance to feel virtuous. There wasn't much they could do besides make the patients drink liters of sugary tea so they wouldn't get dehydrated, keep them clean, warm, and in bed, with the hope that the trots would not drain their souls or fever cook their bones. Some died, and the rest took weeks to come back to the world. Joe was the only person who had the pluck to defy the winter and ride out to the most isolated cabins. Sometimes she found bodies turned to ice statues. They weren't all victims of disease. More than once, the fellow had shot himself in the mouth because he couldn't take any more growling guts, loneliness, and delirium. Once or twice, Joe had to close her business because the floor of the barn was crowded with mats and her doves had all they could do to take care of the patients. The town sheriff trembled when Joe appeared with her Dutch pipe and booming prophet's voice to demand help. No one could refuse her. The same men who gave a bad name to the town tamely submitted to helping her. There was nothing resembling a hospital. The only doctor was worn out, and Joe just naturally assumed the task of mobilizing forces when there was an emergency. The lucky ones whose lives she saved became her devout debtors, and during that winter she wove the web of connections that would sustain her after the fire. The blacksmith's name was James Morton, and he was one of the few good men in the town. He felt an unassailable love for all humanity, including his ideological enemies, whom he considered errant out of ignorance, not intrinsic sinfulness. Incapable of a mean act, he could not imagine one in his neighbor. He preferred to believe that perverseness was a twist of character that could be remedied, once exposed to the light of piety and affection. He came from a long line of Ohio Quakers, where he had worked with his brothers and sisters in an underground railroad for runaway slaves, first hiding them, then leading them to free states and to Canada. His activities had drawn the ire of slaveholders, and one night a mob attacked their farm and set fire to the buildings. His family had watched without lifting a hand because, faithful to their beliefs, they could not take up arms against a fellow man. The Mortons had to disperse and leave their land behind, but they kept in close contact through the humanitarian network of abolitionists. James did not consider prospecting for gold to be an honorable way to earn a living, because it did not create anything or perform a service. Riches debase the soul, complicate life, and engender unhappiness, he maintained. Besides, gold was a soft metal, useless for making tools. He could not understand the fascination it held for others. Tall, robust, with a luxuriant chestnut-colored beard, bright blue eyes and muscular arms scarred from countless burns, lighted by the glow of his forge, he was the reincarnation of the god Vulcan. In the town, there were only three Quakers, men who cherished hard work and family, content with their lot, the only men who did not swear, drink, or frequent the whorehouses. They met regularly to practice their faith, modestly, preaching by example, while patiently awaiting the arrival of a group of friends from the East who were coming to swell their community. Morton was often at Joe Bonecrusher's shack to help with victims of the epidemic, and there he met Esther. He would visit her and pay her the regular fee, but all he did was sit with her and talk. He could not understand how she had chosen the life she had. "Between my father's beatings and this, I prefer the life I have 1,000 times over.
Why did he beat you?
He accused me of provoking lust and inciting sin. He believed that Adam would still be in paradise if Eve hadn't tempted him. Maybe he was right. You see how I'm earning my living.
There is other work, Esther.
This isn't so bad, James. I close my eyes and think of nothing. It's just a few minutes, and then it's over.
Despite the vicissitudes of her profession, the girl had kept the freshness of her 20 years, and there was a certain charm in her discreet and silent bearing, so different from that of her companions. There was nothing of the flirt about her. She was plump, with a placid bovine face and a strong country girl's hands. Compared to the other doves, she was the least pretty, but her skin was glowing and her gaze gentle. The blacksmith didn't know when he had begun to dream about her, to see her in the sparks of his forge, in the flare of the hot metal and in the cloudless sky, until he was no longer able to ignore that cotton-wool feeling wrapped around his heart, threatening to choke him. Nothing worse could happen than to fall in love with a loose woman. It would be impossible to justify in the eyes of God and his community. He decided to conquer temptation with sweat. He closed himself in his shop and worked like a madman. Some nights you could hear the loud ringing of his hammer until near dawn. As soon as she had a fixed address, Eliza wrote Dao Qian at the Chinese restaurant in Sacramento, telling him her new name and asking his advice about combating dysentery. The only remedy she knew to prevent contagion was a piece of raw meat bound to the navel with a strip of red wool, the way Mama Frisia did in Chile, but that was not producing the hoped-for results. She missed Dao painfully. Sometimes she awoke with Tom No-Tribe in her arms, imagining in the wooziness of half-sleep that it was Dao Qian. But the boy's smoky odor quickly brought her back to reality. No one had the fresh, salt air scent of her friend. The distance that separated them was short in miles, but storms made the route arduous and dangerous. She thought of riding with the mailman to continue her search for Joaquin Andieta, as she had in better weather, but weeks went by as she waited for an opportunity. It wasn't just the winter that got in the way of her plans. During that period, the tension between American miners and the Chileans in the south of the Motherlode had exploded. The Yankees, fed up with the foreigners, joined together to run them out, but the Chileans fought back, first with weapons and then before a judge who recognized their rights. Far from intimidating the aggressors, the judge's order merely fired them up. Several Chileans ended up on the gallows or thrown off cliffs, and the survivors had to flee. In answer, they formed gangs of marauders, as many Mexicans had done. Eliza realized that given her disguise as a Latin youth, she could not risk being accused of some invented crime. The last days of January 1850 witnessed one of the worst ice storms ever seen in those parts. No one dared leave shelter. The town seemed dead, and for more than 10 days not a single customer came to the barn. It was so cold that at dawn, water in the wash basins was frozen solid, even though the stoves were kept burning, and some nights they had to bring Eliza's horse indoors to save it from the fate of other animals that woke up in blocks of ice. The girl slept 2 to a bed, and Eliza paired up with the Indian boy, for whom she felt a ferocious and jealous affection, which he returned with stubborn constancy. The only person among them who could compete with Eliza for the boy's affection was Joe Bonecrusher. "Someday I'm going to have a strong, courageous son like Tom No-Tribe, but much happier," Eliza wrote Dao Qian. "This little one never laughs." Babalu the Bear did not know how to sleep at night, and spent the long hours of darkness pacing from one end of the barn to the other, in his Russian boots and seedy furs, with a blanket over his shoulders. He had stopped shaving his head and was sprouting a fuzz that matched his wolfskin jacket. Esther had knitted him a gosling yellow wool cap that covered his head to the ears, and gave him the look of a monstrous baby. He was the one who heard a few faint knocks that morning and had the good sense to distinguish it from the noise of the storm. He opened the door a crack with pistol in hand and found a bundle heaped in the snow. Alarmed, he called Joe, and between them, fighting to keep the wind from tearing the door off its hinges, they dragged it inside. It was a half-frozen man. It was not easy to resuscitate their visitor. While Babalu rubbed him and tried to get some brandy down his throat, Joe waked the women, put more wood in the stove, and set water to heat for the bathtub, where they soaked him until gradually he began to revive, lose his blue color, and mumble a few words. His nose, feet, and hands were frostbitten. He was a campesino from the Mexican state of Sonora, he said, who had come to the California placers like thousands of his compatriots. His name was Jack, a name that doubtlessly wasn't his, but after all, no one else in that household used the one he was born with. For a few hours, Jack was several times on the threshold of death, but just when it seemed that nothing more could be done for him, he fought back from the other world and gagged down a few swallows of liquor. At about 8 o'clock, when the storm had let up, Joe sent Babalu for the doctor. Overhearing her, the Mexican, who had been lying motionless, gulping for air like a fish, opened his eyes and shouted an ear-splitting no that startled everyone. No one was to know he was there, he commanded, with such ferocity that none of them dared cross him. Explanations were not necessary. It was obvious the man was in trouble with the law, and that town, with a gallows in the middle of the square, was the last place in the world a fugitive would want to look for asylum. Only the cruelty of the storm had forced him there. Eliza said nothing, but the man's reaction was no surprise to her. He smelled of evil. After 3 days, Jack had regained some of his strength, but he lost the tip of his nose, and 2 fingers on his left hand were showing signs of gangrene. Not even that convinced him of the need to see the doctor. He would rather rot by inches than hang, he said. Joe Bonecrusher gathered her people at the other end of the barn and held a whispered conference. His fingers had to be amputated. All eyes turned to Babalu, the bad.
Me? Not fucking likely. Babalu, you son of a bitch, don't be such a panty waste, shouted Joe, furious. You do it, Joe. I'm not good for things like that. If you can cut up a deer, you can do this. What's a couple of lousy fingers? An animal is one thing. A human being is something else. No, I can't believe it. It's no good, son of a bitch, begging your pardon, girls. Can't do me this one little favor. After everything I've done for you, you bastard. Sorry, Joe. I've never harmed a hair on anyone's head. What are you telling me? You never killed anyone? You never did time in prison? That was for stealing cattle, the giant confessed, near tears with humiliation.
I will do it, Eliza interrupted, pale but decided. Everyone stared at her, incredulous. Even Tom No Tribe seemed a more likely candidate than the delicate Chile boy.
I'll need a really sharp knife, a hammer, a needle thread, and clean rags.
Babalu sank to the floor with his huge head in his hands, horrified, while the girls got everything ready in respectful silence. Eliza reviewed what she had learned at Dao Chen's side when he had extracted bullets and stitched up wounds in Sacramento. If she had watched that without blinking, she should be able to do this now, she thought. The most important thing, according to her friend, was to prevent hemorrhaging and infection. She had not watched him do amputations, but when he was treating unlucky patients whose ears had been cut off, he had commented that in other lands they cut off hands and feet for the same crime. The executioner's axe is quick, but it doesn't leave any tissue to cover the stump of the bone, Dao Chen had told her. He described what he had been taught by Ebenezer Hobbs, who had experience with war wounds and had shown him what to do. At least in this case it was only fingers, Eliza concluded. Joe Bonecrusher poured enough liquor down the patient to render him unconscious, while Eliza disinfected the knife by heating it red hot. She had them sit Jack in a chair. She wet the hand in a basin of whiskey and then placed it on the edge of the table with the bad fingers separated from the others. She murmured one of Mama Frisia's magical prayers and, when she was ready, gave a wordless signal to the girls to hold down the patient. She positioned the knife on the fingers and hit it smartly with the hammer, driving the blade cleanly through the bones and into the wood of the table. Jack let out a yell from the depths of his guts, but he was so drunk he didn't feel a thing as Eliza stitched the fingers and Esther bandaged them. The torture was over in a few minutes. Eliza stood staring at the amputated fingers, trying to keep from vomiting, while the women laid Jack on one of the mats. Babalu the Bad, who had kept his distance from the spectacle, walked up timidly, baby's cap in hand, and admiringly murmured, "You're a real man, chilly boy." In March, Eliza quietly turned 18, still waiting for Joaquin to show up at their house one day, just as Babalu had said any man within 100 miles would do. Jack, the Mexican, had recovered after a few days, and before his fingers healed, had sneaked off at night without telling anyone goodbye. He was a sinister brute, and everyone was happy he was gone. He didn't talk much and was forever edgy, defiant, ready to spring at the hint of an imagined provocation. He showed no sign of gratitude for the help he had received, just the opposite. When the whiskey wore off and he learned that his trigger finger had been amputated, he let loose a string of curses and threats, swearing that the dog who had mutilated his hand would pay with his life. That was when Babalu's patience wore thin. He picked Jack up like a doll, lifted him up to his eye level, and said in the soft voice he used when he was about to explode, "That was me, Babalu the Bad. Any problem with that?" As soon as his fever was gone, Jack wanted to cash in on the opportunity to use the doves for his pleasure, but as one, they rejected him. They were not about to give anything away, and he had empty pockets, which they had observed when they undressed him to put him in the bathtub the night he had come to their door, half frozen. Joe Bonecrusher took the trouble to explain to Jack that if they hadn't amputated his fingers, he would have lost an arm, probably his life, and that he should be thanking his lucky stars that he had stumbled onto them. Eliza would not allow Tom Notribe to go anywhere near the man, and she approached him only to hand him food or change his bandages, because his odor of evil was as disturbing to her as a tangible presence. Babalu couldn't stand him either, and refused to speak to him all the time he was under their roof. He thought of the girls as his sisters, and was wild whenever Jack obscenely tried to wheedle sex. Not even when he was most desperate would it have occurred to Babalu to use his companion's professional services. In his mind, that would have been the same as incest. If his urges got too strong, he went to the local competition, and he instructed Chile Boy to do the same, in the improbable case that he got over his missy-sissy habits. Once, when she was handing Jack a bowl of soup, Eliza worked up the courage to ask him about Joaquin Andieta.
"Murrieta?" he asked, suspicious.
"Andieta."
"Don't know him."
"Maybe it's the same person," Eliza suggested.
"What do you want with him?"
"He's my brother. I came from Chile to find him."
"What's your brother look like?"
"He's not very tall, and he has black hair and eyes and white skin like me, but we don't look alike. He's thin, muscular, brave, and passionate. When he talks, everyone listens."
"That's Joaquin Murrieta, all right, but he's not Chilean, he's Mexican."
"Are you sure?"
"Sure. I'm not sure of anything, but if I see Murrieta, I'll tell him you're looking for him."
It was the next night that he left, and they heard nothing more from him. But 2 weeks afterward, they found a 2-pound sack of coffee at the door. A little later, when Eliza opened it to fix breakfast, she found that it wasn't coffee, but gold dust. According to Joe Bonecrusher, it could have come from any of the sick miners they had looked after, but Eliza had a strong intuition that Jack had left it as his payment. He was a man who didn't want to owe anyone a favor. On Sunday, they learned that the sheriff was organizing a party of vigilantes to look for the murderer of a miner who had been found in the cabin where he had spent the winter alone, with 9 knife wounds in his chest and slashed eyes. There was no trace of his gold, but because of the brutality of the crime, they had placed the blame on Indians. Joe Bonecrusher, who did not want to get mixed up in any trouble, buried the 2 pounds of gold beneath an oak and ordered all her people to keep their mouths shut, and not under any condition mention the Mexican with the amputated fingers or the sack of coffee. In the course of the next 2 months, the vigilantes murdered a half dozen Indians and then forgot the matter because they had more pressing problems. And when the chief of the tribe came with great dignity to ask for an explanation, they killed him too. Indians, blacks, and mulattoes could not testify against a white man. James Morton and the other three Quakers in the town were the only ones who dared confront the mob at the lynching. Unarmed, they formed a circle around the chief, reciting from memory passages of the Bible that prohibited killing one's fellow man. But the crowd pushed them aside. No one knew it was Eliza's birthday, and there was no celebration. But even so, that night of March 15th was memorable for her and for everyone else. Business was again booming at the barn. The Doves were steadily occupied. Chile Boy was banging away at the piano with real gusto, and Joe was spinning optimistic tales. Winter hadn't been so bad, after all. The worst of the epidemic was past, and they had no patients stretched out on the floor. That night, a half-dozen miners were drinking with true dedication, while outside the wind was ripping branches from the pines. At about 11, all hell broke loose. No one could explain how the fire began, but Joe always suspected the other madam. The wood caught fire like Roman candles, and the curtains, silk shawls, and bed canopies flared up within seconds. Everyone got out safely, even managing to throw on a few blankets, and Eliza snatched up the tin box that contained her precious letters. Flames and smoke rapidly engulfed the building, and in less than 10 minutes it was blazing like a torch as half-naked women and tipsy clients watched the spectacle in total helplessness. Eliza thought to count heads and realized with horror that Tom Notribe was missing. The boy had been fast asleep in the bed they shared. Without thinking, she grabbed a quilt from Esther's shoulders, covered her head, and ran inside with one push, flattening the thin partition of blazing wood, followed by Babalu, who yelled at her to stop, not realizing why she was dashing into the fire. Eliza found the boy standing stock still in the swirling smoke, his eyes wide with fright, but perfectly serene. She threw the quilt over him and tried to pick him up, but he was very heavy and she was bent double by a fit of coughing. She dropped to her knees, pushing Tom to make him run outside, but he did not move and both of them would have been reduced to ashes had Babalu not appeared at that instant, picked up one under each arm as if they were parcels, and bolted back outside to be greeted with loud cheers. "Damned kid, what were you doing in there?" Joe scolded as she hugged the small Indian, covering his face with kisses and slapping his cheeks to make him breathe. It was only because the shack was isolated that half the town didn't go up in flames, the sheriff commented later. He had plenty of experience with fires. They happened too frequently around there. A dozen volunteers had responded to the glow in the sky to fight the flames, headed by the blacksmith. But it was too late, and all they could do was rescue Eliza's horse, which everyone had forgot in the confusion of the first minutes, and was still tied in its lean-to, crazed with terror. Joe Bonecrusher lost everything she owned in the world that night, and for the first time was seen to lose heart. With the boy in her arms, she watched the destruction, unable to hold back the tears, and when all that remained was smoking embers, she buried her face in the enormous chest of Babalu, whose eyelashes and eyebrows were singed. Seeing the surrogate mother, whom they had thought invincible, so vulnerable, the four girls burst out bawling, forming a cluster of petticoats, wind-blown hair, and trembling flesh. The support network, however, had begun to function even before the flames died out, and in less than an hour, lodging had been found for everyone in various homes in town, and one of the miners whom Joe had nursed through dysentery took up a collection. Chile Boy, Babalu, and the young Indian, the three males of the group, spent the night in the blacksmith shop. James Morton laid two straw ticks with warm bed covers beside the still-warm forge and served his guests a splendid breakfast carefully prepared by the wife of the preacher, who on Sunday shouted his loud denunciation of such brazen exhibition of sin, as he referred to the activities of the two brothels. "This is no time for prudery. These poor Christians are shivering," the reverend's wife had said, when she showed up at the smithy with rabbit stew, a pitcher of hot chocolate, and cinnamon cookies. That same lady went door to door collecting clothing for the doves who were still in their petticoats, and the women of the town responded with generosity. They did not like to pass in front of the other madam's establishment, but they had of necessity dealt with Joe Bonecrusher during the epidemic, and they respected her. So that was how the four ladies of the night went around for a while dressed as modest housewives, covered from neck to toe, until they could replace their splendiferous professional outfits. The night of the fire, the preacher's wife wanted to take Tom No-Tribe home, but the boy clung to Babaloo's neck, and no human power could pry him loose. The giant spent sleepless hours with Chile Boy curled up in one arm, and the Indian in the other, piqued no little by the blacksmith's lifted eyebrows.
"You can get that idea out of your head, man. I'm no pansy," he sputtered indignantly, but he did not disturb either of the two sleepers.
The miner's collection and the pouch of gold dust buried beneath the oak were enough to install the victims in a house so comfortable that Joe Bonecrusher had about decided to give up her traveling company and settle down there. While other towns disappeared as the miners moved to new sites, this one grew, maintained its growth, and even thought of changing its name to one more dignified. At the end of winter, new waves of adventurers were climbing into the foothills, and the other madam was getting ready for them. Joe Bonecrusher now had only three girls, because it was obvious that the blacksmith was planning to steal Esther from them, but she wanted to see if she could work things out. Joe had won considerable respect with her compassionate works, and she did not want to give that up. For the first time in her chaotic life, she felt accepted in a community. That was far more than she had in her Pennsylvania Dutch homeland, and at her age, putting down roots did not seem like a bad idea. When Eliza heard those plans, she decided that if Joaquin Andieta, or Murrieta, had not appeared by spring, she would have to tell her friends goodbye and keep looking for him. Disillusion. At the end of autumn, Dao Chen received Eliza's latest letter, which had passed from hand to hand for several months, following him to San Francisco. He had left Sacramento in April. Winter in that city seemed to go on and on. The only thing that sustained him were Eliza's letters, which came sporadically, the hope that Lin's spirit would locate him, and his friendship with his fellow Zhong Yi. Dao had acquired books on Western medicine, and with great pleasure had taken on the patient task of translating them line by line for his friend. In that way, both absorbed at the same time a knowledge very different from their own. They found that in the West, little was known about essential herbs, about preventing illness, or about qi, the bodily energy never mentioned in those texts, but also that Western medicine was more advanced in other aspects. With his friend, Dao spent days comparing and discussing, but study alone could not console him. Isolation and solitude weighed on him so heavily that he abandoned the wooden hut and his garden of medicinal plants and moved to a hotel run by Chinese, where at least he heard his language and ate food to his taste. Even though his patients were very poor and he often treated them for nothing, he had saved money. If Eliza came back, they would move into a house, he thought. But as long as he was alone, the hotel was good enough. The other Zhong Yi planned to send for a young wife from China and settle in the United States, where, despite the fact that he was a foreigner, he would have a better life than in his country. Dao Chen warned him against the vanity of the golden lilies, especially in America, where everyone walked so much and the Fan Wei made fun of a woman with a doll's feet. "Ask the broker to bring you a smiling and healthy wife. Nothing else matters," he counseled, thinking of the brief passage through this world of his unforgettable Lin, and how much happier she would have been with Eliza's feet and strong lungs. His wife was wandering somewhere, lost. She didn't know how to find her way in that foreign land. He invoked her in his meditation and in his poems, but she did not come to him again, not even in his dreams. The last time he had been with her was that day in the hold of the ship, when she visited him wearing her green silk dress and peonies in her hair to ask him to save Eliza. But that had been somewhere near Peru, and since then he had traveled across so much water, land, and time that Lin was surely confused. He imagined her gentle spirit searching for him in this vast, unfamiliar continent, unable to find him. At the Zhongyi's suggestion, he commissioned an artist, a new émigré from Shanghai, to paint her portrait. He was a true tattoo genius, and although the painting followed Dao's precise instructions, it did not do justice to Lin's diaphanous beauty. Dao Chen made a small altar for the portrait where he could sit to summon her. He did not understand why solitude, which he had previously considered a blessing and a luxury, now seemed unbearable. The worst of his years as a sailor had been not having a private space for quiet and silence, but now all he wanted was companionship. The idea of ordering a bride, however, seemed ill-conceived. Once before, the spirits of his ancestors had found him a perfect wife, but behind that apparent good fortune was a hidden curse. He knew what it was to be loved in return, and now could never go back to the times of innocence, where every woman with small feet and a sweet nature seemed enough. He felt condemned to live with the memory of Lin, because no other woman could take her place with dignity. He did not want a servant or a concubine. Not even the need to have sons to honor his name and tend his tomb would induce him. He tried to explain all this to his friend, but he got tangled up in words. There weren't enough in his vocabulary to express his torment. A woman is a creature useful for work, motherhood, and pleasure. But no cultivated and intelligent man would try to make her his companion, his friend had said, the only time Dao tried to confide his feelings. In China, one glance around made that reasoning understandable, but in America, the relationship between husband and wife seemed different. To begin with, no one had concubines, at least not openly. To Dao Chen's mind, the few Fan Wei families he had met in this land of solitary men were beyond comprehension. He could not imagine how they behaved in private, given that apparently the husbands treated their wives as equals. It was a mystery that he was interested in exploring, like so many others in this extraordinary country. Eliza's first letters were delivered to the restaurant, and as the Chinese community knew Dao Chen, they were not long in reaching him. Those lengthy missives, rich with details, were his best company. Remembering Eliza, he was surprised at how much he missed her, because he had never thought that friendship with a woman was possible, to say nothing of one from a different culture. He had almost always seen her in masculine clothing, but he thought of her as totally feminine, and was surprised that others accepted her disguise without asking questions. "Men never really look at other men, and the women think I'm an effeminate boy," she had written in one letter. To him, on the other hand, she was the girl dressed in white, whose corset he had removed in a fishing hut in Valparaiso. The sick girl who had delivered herself without reservation to his care in the hold of the ship. The warm body snuggled against his on icy nights beneath the canvas roof. He heard her happy voice humming as she cooked, and remembered her serious expression when she helped him treat wounded patients. He no longer saw her as a young girl, but as a woman, despite her airy bones and youthful face. He thought about how different she looked after she cut her hair, and regretted not having kept the braid, a thought that had occurred to him at the time, but had been discarded as a shameful bit of sentimentality. At least now he could have it in his hands to summon the presence of that singular friend. When he meditated, he never failed to send protective energy to help her survive the 1,000 deaths and possible disasters he tried not to think about, because he knew that one who thinks of bad things ends up convoking them. Sometimes Dao dreamed about Eliza and woke in a sweat. Then he would throw his I Ching sticks to reveal the unseen. In those ambiguous messages, Eliza always appeared moving toward the mountain. That calmed him somewhat. In September of 1850, Dao was present at the noisy patriotic celebration when California became the newest state in the Union. The American nation took in the whole continent, from the Atlantic to the Pacific. By then, the fever for gold was beginning to take the shape of enormous collective disillusion, and Dao saw masses of debilitated and impoverished miners waiting their turns to sail back where they had come from. The newspapers estimated that more than 90,000 were going home. Sailors were no longer deserting. On the contrary, there weren't enough ships to carry everyone who wanted to leave. One out of every five miners had died of disease, cold, or drowning in the rivers. Many were murdered or had shot themselves in the head. Foreigners were still coming, having embarked months earlier. But the gold was no longer within easy reach of any bold adventurer with a pan, a shovel, and a pair of boots. The time of solitary heroes was over, and in their place were powerful companies equipped with machines, able to open mountains with forceful bursts of water. Miners were working on salary, and the ones getting rich were the empresarios, as avid for sudden wealth as the adventurers of 49, but much cleverer. Like that tailor named Levi, who was making pants with double seams and metal studs, the obligatory miner's uniform. At the same time that many were leaving, the Chinese kept streaming in like mute ants. Dao Chen often translated the English-language newspapers for his friend, the Zhongyi, who particularly liked the articles of a certain Jacob Fremont because they coincided with his own opinions. "Thousands of Argonauts are returning home defeated without having found the Golden Fleece, their odyssey turned into tragedy. But many others, though poor, are staying because now they cannot live anywhere else. 2 years in this wild and beautiful country transforms men. The danger, the adventure, and the good health and vigor they have known in California are not found anywhere else. Gold fulfilled its function. It attracted the men who are conquering this region and making of it the promised land. That is irreversible," wrote Fremont. Dao Chen, however, felt that he was living in a paradise of greedy, materialistic, and impatient people whose obsession was to get rich quick. There was no food for the spirit. Instead, violence and ignorance prospered. All other evils derived from those, he was convinced. He had seen a lot in his 27 years and did not consider himself a prude, but he was shocked by the standards of behavior and the impunity of crime. Such a place was destined to choke in the muck of its own vices, he maintained. He had lost hope of finding in America the peace he so desired. Definitely, this was not the place for one who aspired to wisdom. So why was he so strongly attracted to it? He must avoid being bewitched by this land, as had happened to so many who had come here. He intended either to go back to Hong Kong or to visit his friend Ebenezer Hobbs in England, where they could study and practice together. In the years that had gone by since he was shanghaied onto the Liberty, he had written several letters to the English physician, but during the days at sea, it had taken a long time to get an answer, until finally in Valparaiso in February of 1849, Captain John Summers had received a letter for him and delivered it to him. In it, his friend told him that he was practicing surgery in London, although his true calling was to mental illnesses, a new field just being explored by science. Dao Chen planned to work for a while in Daifao, the great city, as the Chinese called San Francisco, and then sail to China, in case Ebenezer Hobbs did not answer his most recent letter within a reasonable time. He was amazed to see how San Francisco had changed in little more than a year. Instead of the noisy camp of huts and tents he remembered, he saw a city with well-planned streets and buildings of several floors, organized and prosperous, with new dwellings going up everywhere. A catastrophic fire had destroyed several blocks 3 months earlier. One could still see the ruins of burned-out buildings. But the coals were not yet cool before everyone had taken hammer in hand to rebuild. There were luxury hotels with verandas and balconies, casinos, bars and restaurants, elegant carriages, along with an unattractive, badly dressed, multicultural throng, among whom stood out the top hats of a few dandies. The rest were mud-covered, bearded types with the look of villains, although no one was who he seemed. The stevedore on the dock might be a Latin American aristocrat, and the coach driver a New York lawyer. After a minute's conversation with any of those intimidating-looking types, one might uncover an educated man who, at the least pretext, with tears in his eyes, would pull out a wrinkled letter from his wife. And the opposite also happened. The foppish, well-cut suit might well conceal an unmitigated scoundrel. Dao did not see any schools in his walk through the center. Instead, he saw children working like adults, digging holes, carrying bricks, driving mules in shining boots. But as soon as the breeze blew in from the ocean, they would run to fly kites. Later, he learned that many of them were orphans and that they roamed the streets in gangs, stealing food to survive. There were few women, and when one strolled elegantly down the street, traffic stopped to let her pass. At the foot of Telegraph Hill, where there was a semaphore flying flags to signal the registry of ships entering the bay, lay a few blocks in which there was no shortage of women. That was the Red Light District, controlled by ruffians from Australia, Tasmania, and New Zealand. Dao Chen had heard of them and knew it was no place for a Chinese man to venture by himself after sunset. Peering into shops, he saw they were offering the same goods he had seen in London when he stopped there. Everything came by sea, even a cargo of cats sold individually like luxury items to wage war against the rats. The forest of masts of ships abandoned in the bay was reduced to a tenth. Many had been scuttled to make landfill for construction, or had been converted into hotels, storehouses, jails, and even an insane asylum, where poor wretches lost in the unreachable delirium of alcohol were sent to die. Such a haven was badly needed, since previously they had tied lunatics to trees. Dao Chen headed for Chinatown and found that the rumors were true. His countrymen had built a complete city in the heart of San Francisco, where Mandarin and Cantonese were spoken, signs were all in Chinese, and the only faces were Chinese. The illusion of being transported to the Celestial Empire was perfect. Dao took a room in a decent hotel and prepared to practice medicine as long as necessary, to earn a little more money because he had a long journey ahead of him. Something happened, however, that would overturn his plans and hold him in the city. "My karma was not to find peace in a monastery in the mountains, as I sometimes dreamed, but to fight a merciless, no-holds-barred war," he concluded many years later, when he could look back at his past and see clearly the roads he had traveled and those not taken. Months later, he received Eliza's last letter in a dirty, wrinkled envelope. Paulina Rodriguez de Santa Cruz descended from the Fortuna like an empress, surrounded by her entourage and 93 trunks. Captain John Summers' third trip with the ice had been true torment for him, the other passengers, and the crew. Paulina let everyone know that the ship was hers, and to prove it, she contradicted the captain and gave arbitrary orders to the sailors. She had a stomach like an elephant and was not even slowed by seasickness. She was such a good sailor that her appetite merely increased. Her children continually got lost in the crannies of the ship, even though their nannies never took their eyes off them, and when that happened, the alarms sounded and they had to shut down the boilers because the hysterical mother screamed that her children had fallen overboard. The captain tried to explain, as delicately as possible, that were that the case, she would have had to resign herself to it because the Pacific would already have swallowed them up, but she ordered him to lower the lifeboats. Sooner or later, the children would surface, and after several hours of high drama, they would resume their voyage. Paulina's objectionable little lapdog, however, did lose its footing one day and slipped into the ocean in front of several witnesses, who watched without a word. Paulina's husband and brother-in-law were waiting on the dock in San Francisco, with a row of carriages and wagons to transport the family in the trunks. The residence constructed for her, an elegant Victorian house, had been shipped in crates from England with numbered pieces and blueprints for putting it together. The wallpaper, furniture, harp, piano, lamps, even porcelain figurines and bucolic paintings to adorn it were also imported. Paulina did not like it. Compared to her marble mansion in Chile, this new one looked like a dollhouse that had threatened to collapse every time she leaned against a wall. But for the moment, there was no alternative, and she needed only one look at the effervescent city to realize its possibilities.
"Here is where we are going to live, Feliciano. The first to arrive become aristocracy in a couple of years."
"You already have that in Chile, woman."
"I do, but you don't. Believe me, this will be the most important city of the Pacific.
founded by swine and horse.
Precisely. They are the ones most eager for respectability.
No one will be more respectable than the Cross family.
What a shame these people cannot pronounce our real name. Cross is a name for cheesemakers, but after all, I suppose one cannot have everything.
That night, Captain John Summers went to the best restaurant in the city, eager to eat and drink well and forget his 5 weeks in the company of that woman. He had brought several boxes of the newest illustrated editions of erotic books. The success of the first had been stupendous, and he hoped his sister Rose would work up the spirit to write again. Ever since Eliza's disappearance, she had been in a slew of sadness and had not once taken up her pen. His mood had been affected, too.
"Shit, I'm getting old,"
he said when he realized he was foundering in futile nostalgia. He had never had time to enjoy his daughter, to take her to England as he had planned, nor had he told her he was her father. He was fed up with deceit and mystery. The business of the books was another family secret. 15 years ago, when his sister had confessed that behind Jeremy's back she was writing lewd stories to keep from dying of boredom, he had come up with the idea of publishing them in London, where the market for erotica had prospered, along with prostitution and clubs for flagellants, the longer the rigid Victorian moral code was imposed. In a remote province in Chile, seated before a small dressing table of blonde wood, with no source of inspiration but memories of her one love affair, inflated and polished 1,000 times over, his sister produced novel after novel signed by an anonymous lady. No one believed that those steamy stories, some with a tone suggestive of the Marquis de Sade and already classics of their genre, were written by a woman. It was the captain's job to take the manuscripts to the editor, monitor expenses, collect the earnings, and deposit them in a London bank for his sister. It was his way of paying her for the huge favor she had done him by taking in his daughter and saying nothing. He could not remember Eliza's mother, but if the girl had inherited her mother's physical characteristics, she had undoubtedly gotten from him her urge for adventure. Where could she be, and with whom? Rose insisted she had gone to California after her lover, but the more time that passed, the more he doubted that. His friend, Jacob Todd, now Fremont, who had made the search for Eliza a personal mission, assured him that she had never set foot in San Francisco. Fremont met the captain for dinner and then invited him to a frivolous show in one of the dance halls in the red light district. He told Summers that Ah Toy, the Chinese woman they had peered at through the holes in the wall, now had a chain of brothels and an elegant salon, staffed by the finest Oriental girls, some barely 11 years old, and trained to satisfy every whim. He said they weren't going there, however, but to see the Turkish harem dancers. Soon afterward, they were smoking and drinking in a 2-story building decorated with large marble tables, polished bronzes, and paintings of mythological nymphs pursued by fauns. Women of several races attended the clientele, served drinks, and presided over the gaming tables under the vigilant gaze of armed pimps, all dressed with eye-popping affectation. On both sides of the main salon, in private rooms, was high-stakes betting. That was where the real tigers gambled, risking thousands in one night. Politicians, judges, merchants, lawyers, and criminals, all equals in the same mania. The performance was a fiasco in the eyes of the captain, who had seen authentic belly dancing in Istanbul, and had no trouble recognizing that those clumsy girls were undoubtedly from the last group of whores to arrive from Chicago. The audience, most of whom were uneducated miners who couldn't have found Turkey on a map, whooped their approval of those odalisques barely covered by bead skirts. Bored, the captain drifted to one of the betting tables, where, with incredible dexterity, a female dealer was shuffling the cards for Monte. A different woman came up to him, grasped his arm, and breathed an invitation into his ear. He turned to look at her. She was a plump, common South American, but she wore an expression of genuine happiness. He was about to send her on her way because he was planning to spend the rest of the night with one of the expensive whores he had visited on earlier trips to San Francisco, when his eyes focused on her décolletage. Between her breasts was a gold brooch set with turquoise stones.
"Where did you get that?" he cried, gripping her shoulders with two hands. "It's mine. I bought it," she blurted out, terrified.
"Where?"
And he shook her so roughly that one of the thugs sauntered toward them.
"Any trouble, mister?" he asked threateningly.
The captain made a sign that he wanted some time with this woman and hustled her off to one of the cubicles on the second floor. He closed the curtain and with a single slap tumbled her back on the bed.
"You're going to tell me where you got that brooch, or I'm going to knock all your teeth out. Is that clear?"
"I didn't steal it, I swear. Someone gave it to me."
"Who?"
"You won't believe me when I tell you."
"Try me."
"A girl, a long time ago, on a boat."
And Azucena Placeres had no choice but to tell that man possessed that a Chinese cook had given her the brooch in payment for looking after a poor little girl who was dying from a miscarriage in the hold of a ship in the middle of the Pacific Ocean. As she talked, the captain's anger turned to horror.
"What happened to her?" asked John Summers, his head in his hands, stunned.
"I don't know, senor."
"I'll give you anything you want, woman. Just tell me what happened to her," he begged, dropping a sheaf of bills in her skirt.
"Who are you?"
"I'm her father."
"She bled to death, and we threw her body into the ocean. I swear that's the truth,"
Azucena Placeres replied without a second's pause, because she thought that if the poor girl had traveled half the world hidden like a rat in a hole, it would be an unforgivable betrayal on her part to set the father on her trail. Eliza spent the summer in the town because, with one thing and another, the days got away from her. First, Babalu the Bad had a near-fatal attack of dysentery, which set off a panic since the epidemic was supposed to be under control. For months, there had been no cases to mourn except the death of a 2-year-old boy, the first child to be born and die in that stopping-off place for newcomers and adventurers. That baby had put a seal of authenticity on the town, for now it was no longer an illusory camp with a gallows as its only reason to figure on the maps. It had a Christian cemetery, and the tiny grave of someone whose entire life had been spent there. During the time Joe Bonecrusher's barn had been turned into a hospital, all of them had miraculously been spared from the epidemic. Miraculously, because Joe didn't believe in contagion. She said everything was a matter of luck. The world is filled with plagues. Some get them, and some don't. That was why she didn't take precautions. She allowed herself the luxury of ignoring the common-sense warnings of the doctor, and only under pressure boiled the drinking water. Once they had moved into a real house, they all felt safe. If they hadn't been infected before, they wouldn't now. But within a few days, Babalu was down. Then it became the turn of Joe Bonecrusher, the girls from Missouri, and the beautiful Mexican. They succumbed with vile diarrhea, fevers you could fry an egg on, and uncontrollable chills, which in Babalu's case shook the house. Then came James Morton in his Sunday clothes to ask formally for Esther's hand.
"Oh, son, you couldn't have chosen a worse time," sighed Joe Bonecrusher. But she was too sick to object, and between moans gave her consent. Esther divided her belongings among her companions because she did not want to take anything to her new life. And they were married that same day without much fuss, attended by Tom No Tribe and Eliza, the only two of their company who weren't sick. A double row of Esther's former customers lined both sides of the street as the couple went by, shooting into the air and yelling congratulations. The couple moved into the blacksmith shop, determined to make it their home and forget the past. But still, they went every day to Joe's house, taking hot meals and clean clothing to the ill. The unpleasant task of nursing everyone fell to Eliza and Tom No Tribe. The town doctor, a young man from Philadelphia who for months had been warning that the water was polluted with waste from the miners upriver without anyone's giving him the time of day, quarantined Joe's house. Their finances went from bad to worse, but they did not go hungry, thanks to Esther and the anonymous gifts that mysteriously appeared at the door, a sack of beans, a few pounds of sugar, tobacco, small pouches of gold dust, silver dollars. To tend her friends, Eliza called on what she had learned in her girlhood from Mama Frisia and from Dao Chen in Sacramento, until finally, one by one,
her friends began to recuperate, although for a long time they were unsteady and befuddled. Babalu the Bad had suffered the most. His cyclops girth was unaccustomed to bad health. He lost weight, and his flesh hung so loose, his tattoos were unrecognizable. During that time, a brief news item was published in the local newspaper about a Chilean or Mexican, no one was sure which, bandit named Joaquin Murrieta, who was becoming famous up and down the Motherlode. By then, violence was the rule in Gold Country. Disillusioned when they learned that sudden fortune, a mockery of a miracle, had come to only a few, the Americans accused foreigners of being greedy and of getting rich without contributing to the nation's prosperity. Liquor fired them up, and impunity in doling out punishment gave them an irrational sense of power. An American was never sentenced for crimes against another race. Still worse, a white criminal often could choose his own jury. Racial hostility turned into blind hatred. Mexicans refused to accept the loss of their territory in the war or to be run off their ranches and the mines. The Chinese bore abuse silently. They did not leave, but kept prospecting, not earning enough for a flea, but with such infinite tenacity that grain by grain they amassed wealth. Thousands of Chileans and Peruvians, who had been the first to arrive when gold fever blossomed, decided to return to their countries because it wasn't worth pursuing their dreams under such conditions. That year, 1850, the legislature of California approved a tax on mining operations designed to protect whites. Blacks and Indians were left out unless they worked like slaves. Foreigners had to pay $20 and renew rights to their claim monthly, which in practice was impossible. They couldn't leave the placers to travel several weeks to the city to obey the law, but if they didn't, the sheriff took over their mine and gave it to an American. The people in charge of enforcing those measures were chosen by the governor and earned their salaries from taxes and fines, a perfect setup for encouraging corruption. The law applied only to dark-skinned foreigners, even though according to the treaty that ended the war in 1848, the Mexicans had rights to American citizenship. Another decree was the last nail in the coffin. Claims on their ranches, where they had lived for generations, had to be ratified by a court in San Francisco. This procedure took years and cost a fortune. In addition, the judges and constables were often the same ones who had appropriated the claims. In view of the fact that the law did not protect them, some Mexicans decided to act outside it, spiritedly throwing themselves into the role of outlaws. Men who formerly had been content to steal cattle now attacked solitary miners and travelers. Some gangs were famous for their cruelty. They not only robbed the victims, they took pleasure in torturing them before they killed them. There was talk of one particular bandido to whom they attributed, among other offenses, the terrible death of two young Americans. Their bodies were found tied to a tree with signs of having been used as a target for knife throwers. Their tormentors had also cut out their tongues, pierced their eyes, and cut off live flesh before leaving them to slowly die. This criminal was called Three Finger Jack, and it was said that he was right-hand man to Joaquin Murrieta. Not everything was savagery, nevertheless. The cities were developing, and new towns were springing up and families moving in. Newspapers, theater companies, and orchestras were organized. Schools, churches, and banks were constructed. Roads were built, and communications improved. There was stagecoach service and regular mail delivery. Women were less a novelty now, and a society was flourishing that aspired to order and morality, replacing the disaster of solitary men and prostitutes. There was an attempt to establish the rule of law and to return to the civilization forgotten in the delirium of easy gold. The town was given a respectable name in a solemn ceremony featuring a marching band and a parade, which Joe Bonecrusher attended dressed as a woman for the first time and backed by her entire company. Wives who had only recently arrived blanched when they saw the painted women, but as Joe and her girls had saved so many lives during the epidemic, they overlooked their activities. On the other hand, they declared war on the other brothel, a losing battle nonetheless, since there was still only one woman for every 9 men. At the end of that year, James Morton welcomed 5 families of Quakers who had crossed the continent in ox carts, not for gold, but drawn by the vastness of that virgin land. By now, Eliza had no idea what trail to follow. Joaquin Andieta had evaporated in the confusion of the times, and in his place had begun to materialize an outlaw with the same physical description and similar name, a figure she found impossible to identify with the noble young man she loved. The author of the letters she kept as her only treasure could not be the same person as the one to whom such horrendous crimes were attributed. The man she loved would never have associated with a cold-blooded killer like Three Finger Jack, she was sure. But her conviction melted away at night when Joaquin appeared to her wearing 1,000 different masks and bringing 1,000 contradictory messages. She would wake up trembling, besieged by the raving specters of her nightmares. She had lost the ability to come and go from her dreams at will, as Mama Frisia had taught her as a child, nor could she decipher the visions and symbols that kept rattling in her head like pebbles rolling in the river. She wrote tirelessly in her diary, hoping as she did so that the images would acquire some meaning. She reread the love letters syllable by syllable, seeking clarifying signs but finding only deeper perplexity. Those letters were the one proof of her lover's existence, and she clung to them so as not to lose her bearings completely. The temptation to fall into apathy as a way to escape the torment of continuing her search for Joaquin was becoming irresistible. She doubted everything. The embraces in the room of the armoires, the months buried in the hold of the ship, the baby that had bled out of her.